You are listening to The Dystopian Republic, and I, Raul Guerrero, am your host. We begin today's story on the mid-morning of August 3rd, 2012. Summer was still going mildly strong in the increasingly metropolitan city of Samalba, Albaland. For most, a day where nothing profound was expected to happen. That continued the societal peace that began in May and carried over to June, July, and the first 2 days of August. This allowed Austin, Andre, Arlo, and Avery to sneak into Abeland and become Loretta T, Marone K, Lamar R, and Agnes B, respectively. The main talk on Abelandic TV was how the breeze made it difficult for temperatures to remain within reach of 60 degrees. The cousins made a pact to address themselves by their birth names whenever they were among themselves and by their new ones otherwise. This took a bit of time to get used to, but when August 3rd came around, they had it down to a cute, clever science, allowing them to, in essence, move on with life. Austin was looking at herself in a bathroom mirror, figuring out where the F the bags on her eyes and wrinkles on her forehead came from. Last time she checked, she was a teenager, an adult, but still a teen nevertheless, believing that she may want to have those looked at by a doctor. Austin looked at the Abelandic ID she got shortly after arriving and saw no bags or wrinkles on her photo, but when she saw the Loretta T name next to it, she cried as quietly at the sink's basin as she could. She staggered out of the bathroom and found herself in Andre's arms and being told that he missed Maya as profusely as she did. Arlo and Avery saw the embrace, joined it, and made it known that they fought about Grandma every single day. That moment was cut short by a phone call Austin received from her new friend, Roscoe Jr., jolting her into wiping away her tears and greeting him with her grief held in. Andre, Arlo, and Avery couldn't believe their cousin was being buddy-buddy with a man old enough to be her stepfather. Roscoe's reason for calling Loretta T, Austin, was to know if she was ready for him to pick her up, getting told that 2 hours were needed. He respected that and said the wait will make the fun that awaits him and her even more worth it. Hanging up after I love yous doused in syrup were exchanged. Roscoe went back to applying the final touches on a painting he made of Loretta, depicting her as an angel with looks that could kill. He smiled at it and thanked the Almighty Lord for letting such a beautiful person enter his life, promising to treat her like a princess. Interrupted by a ring of his home's doorbell, Roscoe opened the door and found a small package sitting on his welcome mat. He found its lack of a name or address odd, but slid it open anyway and uncovered a disc complying with its red inked tell for him to play it. Dressed in all black, in a lightless room, a skull-masked person greeted Roscoe with an automated voice that weirded him out. They assumed that he was surprised to hear from them again and told him that he had some serious catching up to do with them. Slowly shaking his head in utter shock, Roscoe screamed that he had the person locked away like an unholy creature, but what they said next made his heart race and nerves want to puke. Austin got lost in her own world as Avery did her makeup and Arlo dressed her up, all while Andre briefed her on what to do and avoid on her rendezvous. The video Roscoe watched preoccupied him as he showered, dried himself up with a towel, pomaded his crew cut, put on a sky blue polo shirt, pair of light gray chinos, and white loafers. His home had a four-bedroom house, two-car garage, built-in office, and circular lot that rested on a valley slightly bigger than the property. Roscoe's drive to the cousins' home cleared his mind of the video and flooded it with thoughts of him and Loretta prancing through Sumalba like the couple that others wanted to emulate. As suburban as any suburb in upper-middle-class America, Clovisburg was quieter and had an 11th of Sumalba's population density. One two-floor home blended in with the others on a subtly S-shaped avenue known for buzz-cut grass and young birch trees. In its living room, Isidro listened to music on a channel dedicated to playing rock jazz blends from the second millennium's last century. He was barefoot, wore a deep navy white polo, had designer jeans on, and a Ferdinandium coin medallion around his neck. Seeing that it was almost noon on his smartphone, Isidro asked his sweet princess what was taking her so darn long. He was apologized to and assured that the extra time taken wasn't being wasted on something stupid via text, getting several chuckles out of him. The cousins heard a sports car stop in front of their home and honk its horn. Then Loretta got a text from Roscoe that told her that he was here. She stepped outside and shut the door without him seeing Andre, Arlo, or Avery, wowing him with how well-groomed she looked and getting awestruck by his dapperness and what he drove. Loretta sat with Roscoe, greeting and hugging him like a teddy bear, which he didn't like at all, but tolerated to avoid offending her. He asked her if she's ready for a real ride as he pressed and held a button that opened his car's roof and set it to sport mode, unbridling its throttle, brakes, transmission, and steering. Thinking that was cool, Loretta told Roscoe to step on it, laughing and yelling like she was on a roller coaster when he happily did. They went southwest out of Sumalba and to Albalan's southwest coast, arriving at an unincorporated beach miles from any municipalities in all directions. The fog reducing the sunny sky to a yucky brownish gray made the two wish they foresaw the double-digit temperature drop, high winds, and half-mile visibility. Given that the date was 2 weeks in the making, Roscoe and Loretta refused to let less than ideal weather rob them of their day together, walking down old stairs to the shore below the beach's parking lot. Back at the cousins' home, Andre, Arlo, and Avery watched TV and ate leftovers from last night's salmon and chips dinner. Their eating was interrupted by breaking news of a bank robbery in St. John's, Newfoundland, the 7th one to hit eastern Canada in the last few weeks, and latest of an almost year-long string of crimes perpetrated by a group no listener got to learn anything about due to the broadcast losing its signal. Agreeing that the interruption was too perfectly timed, Andre went into Austin's room under her bed and took the untraceable laptop Upton Jr. sent them. He sat down with Arlo and Avery in the home office, booted the computer up, signed in under his name, and clicked on a hidden service, letting the cousins securely communicate with said superior. Andre expressed his concern that Upton may be orchestrating the group responsible for the crime spree consuming eastern Canada. The lack of an immediate response didn't worry Andre or make Arlo afraid, but Avery was sweating over the bad things that may befall her and them for the accusatory message. Upton recommended that the three perish any thought of him making the crimes happen, swearing on the Cisneros' name. He said the little spree had for some time been a source of intrigue for him, but now he had a hunch as to who or what may be at its helm. It appeared to Upton that all evidence pointed to the fascies being at it again, stooping to any low that could be fallen to for the purpose of freeing their side out of the lower hand they've had for a little while. He added that it was a matter of time before those yellow J-offs go abroad, maybe to the United States, perhaps Bermelia, or possibly even Abeland. Upton advised the cousins to enjoy the peace and quiet enveloping their new home because it'll soon come to an end. Yet, he told them not to be scared as his influence was their shield from harm, departing on an assurance that they'll receive their swords before too long. Upton gave those under him the order to identify every person involved in the spree and bring them to him alive. His reason for not wanting them killed when caught was only his to worry about, having a hard time repressing a grief that was over a decade old. Upton walked 5 doors down to a room where some of his lesser minions were acting as civilians on Prysip, working around the clock to sway its civil discourse in his favor and against his enemies. Loretta recorded Roscoe welcoming viewers from across the 7 seas to a very special beach, the location of which he'll never tell. He introduced the rock formation in back of him as being where a pivotal moment in Bromelia's early history took place. Roscoe had Loretta film him climb it with an ease smoother than butter, then had his right foot on its summit and the left one inches below it, flexing his arms so proud of himself. Addressing him as a big boy, she asked him how the misty winds were treating him up there, getting told that they couldn't feel any nicer. Loretta initially resisted Roscoe's nudges to come join him, but after the 5th Aegon, she gave in as the fog largely cleared. She tried imitating his climb, but the formation was made slippery by the moisture from the mist, making it difficult for her to grip it securely. Anticipating that Loretta will be able to get to him, Roscoe was in awe at the nature he could now see from top to bottom. That elation blew out like a glass window when she yelled for him to help her, catching a young woman beating her like an animal. Roscoe ran 2/3 of the way down, leapt onto the sand from the remaining 20 feet, and sprained his ankles on landing. The pain didn't stop him from getting that woman off of Loretta, but what did make his heart ache was how badly beaten his friend was, despite the attack lasting mere seconds. Roscoe was aggressive in his stomp over to the attacker, then a familiar voice told him to touch her at his and his friend's grave peril. His blood running colder than a metal pole in a sub-zero blizzard, he squeaked out a you that was in disbelief over seeing Isidro again. Roscoe Jr.'s memory of himself and his siblings standing before Roscoe Sr. and Sky in Huttonfield was as vivid and painful to reflect on as ever. Isidro asked his brother if he was there or had just gone deaf, telling him to step away from his stepdaughter. Up to her chest in pain, Loretta coughed up and spat out mucus drool mixed with blood, crawling behind Roscoe's left leg like a daughter turning to her father for protection. Isidro's smirk went from subtle to obvious when his brother nervously complied, helping his stepdaughter up and asking her if she was okay. Roscoe was disturbed by how tender and loving his brother was to someone who just perpetrated a savage beating. As badly as Loretta wanted to beat her attacker to a pulp, her fear of being put into a coma or worse scared her into locking away that want and saving it for much later. The attacker smiled at Isidro and said she was a tad shook by being thrown like a rag doll, but had no significant harm done to her. Roscoe had a harder time helping Loretta back to her feet and could tell from looking at her eyes that her injuries weren't minor. Asked if he'd come to settle the score, Isidro assured his brother that not a speck of revenge was on his mind, planning to make today a day for him and his sweet, wholesome Janelle. That answer made Roscoe's stomach juices splash up his esophagus like ocean waves and vaporized whatever appetite Loretta may have had. Isidro said that he and Janelle were as eager to behold the beach and its surrounding nature as he assumed his brother and his apparent step-niece were. Roscoe called Loretta a friend and nothing else, finding it quite inappropriate to look at her in any other way, something she strongly disagreed with. He made it clear to Isidro that they weren't brothers and that his friend will never ever be a niece of his now, tomorrow, next month, or ever. Janelle giggled, stomped a few feet toward Roscoe, and told him he couldn't escape that thing he did that tore the Nunez's apart, saying that he was right to believe that her stepfather told her everything. She called her so-called step-uncle a piece of ass, asked if he knew that, and yelled out a huh that drove through Loretta's left eardrum like a needle. Isidro laughed while advising Roscoe to not involve the police if he wanted that thing he did to remain a family matter. He told Janelle that it's time they leave the coast and seek nicer pastures inland, making her twinkle and join him in walking away, chuckling. Those chuckles were among the most grim that Roscoe had ever heard and made Loretta shiver like a kid in the freezing cold, laying waste to what should have been their best day together yet. Masked people on ATVs zeroed in on an abandoned substation near Lopstick Lake, Labrador, storming inside for an all-hands-on-deck meeting. Wynn told her servitors to give themselves a round of applause for the millions of Canadian dollars now in their possession, declaring the resource-gathering phase as now complete. Holding newspapers, she found it funny that the media was covering her spree from wall to wall while not having any clue who she or her servants were. Wynn was nonetheless appreciative of the free publicity, for it'll instill fear in her enemies, develop new servants, and allow her to put the money she acquired to great use very soon. With business booming at the Somalba Grand Outlets, Nortwit was where Agnes B. Avery tried on a shaggy fleece jacket that won her heart. Marone K. Andre chilled with a few locals at the in-store restaurant who couldn't believe they were speaking to a Klein. Lamar R. Arlo stepped out of a bathroom stall and washed his hands, gasping for air after defecating what may as well have been a boulder. Now, out of the restrooms, he noticed a clearance section that appeared to be out of the sight of any security cameras. Lamar R. felt that itch come in, telling him to conceal a few in his bag, and said it was perfectly okay for him to borrow them indefinitely. He hesitated, but the thefts he and his cousins got away with in Bromelia made him feel that taking one last time wouldn't hurt. Lamar R. walked to the clearance rack, checked if anyone was looking, and when no one was, he shoved a rain jacket, beanie, and sock pack of six into his bag. He secreted the merchandise in the wrapping tissue of the three boot pairs he planned on paying for and looked around one more time for onlookers before deciding to attempt the theft. Agnes B. posed like a model with the jacket as well as a velvet sleeveless tank top that she tucked into gray denims she partly covered a pair of city boots with. She then got a text from Marone K that wanted her and Lamar R to meet him at the ski wear section at once. Agnes B could sense that something was wrong, and the non-stop coverage of the crime spree in Canada did nothing to ease her dread. Marone K informed her and Lamar R that Roscoe told him that Loretta T had a serious accident and was being treated as he spoke. Agnes B. reacted with a gasping, hands over mouth, whiter than snow, and said she knew that Nunez guy was bad news from the start. Marone K. told her to relax because Roscoe swore on his life that he would never cause any harm to Loretta T., but also refused to elaborate on what exactly happened or give one hint of who was responsible. Agnes B. blurted a confused what the F Lamar R. responded to with a why not that felt as though it was in a knot it couldn't undo. Marone K. suspected that the psycho who attacked Loretta T. threatened to kill her and Roscoe if they snitched, which he thought was to be expected considering how incredibly violent the beating was. At the University of Albalanda Hospital, Loretta T. underwent wound care, covering her body in stitches and bandages that ached and stung. Roscoe's heart ached watching his friend be in too much pain to talk to him, wanting to tell her how much she meant to him. He told Loretta T. that his years of being a realtor gave him more money than he knew what to do with, but left him starving for friendship. Roscoe said that his wealth and how he obtained it turned off lots of people, finding that ironic given how many of those same characters never had a bad thing to say about the De Alba royal dynasty. He asked himself who he was kidding. Inheritances were sexier than earnings, believing that the Sajonians would befriend him with open arms. Hearing that made Loretta T. very uncomfortable and suspicious, asking Roscoe who he really was and how he knew Isidro. When all she got was silence, she powered through the pain to demand that he tell her this instant or she'll beat it out of him. Roscoe grabbed Loretta T. by the shirt, slammed her spine first onto the exam bed, and asked if she'll try to kill him like she tried to end Hull's life, addressing her as Austin Palencia with a ravenous grin. Riding with Avery as Arlo drove, Andre received an alert via text that forced entries had been detected at the front and garage office doors. Their drive to the hospital was now a mad dash for home, and when they got there, the intruders were gone, but nothing valuable was taken. Andre, Arlo, and Avery had what they feared realized in Austin's room, where they found the laptop used to communicate with Upton in pieces on the floor. When her real name was said, Austin fought back to when she smothered out Hull and cuddled with him to show how it hurt her more than it did him. Roscoe told her that he figured out her true identity and those of her cousins the moment he heard them speak during that speed date night at the Ferdy Luxor Somalba last month. He asked Austin if she's paid attention to any news regarding how Hull, Gilson, Ray, and Swindon were doing since fleeing Bromelia. She shivered her shake of her head, amusing Roscoe into telling her that the four were in stable condition and expected to recover. Her body froze like frost had formed a skin-like layer over all its every centimeter, horrifying her into begging him to find it in his heart not to turn her or her cousins in. Roscoe laughed, chuckled out a few breaths, and assured Austin that having her, Andre, Arlo, and Avery locked up wasn't on his agenda. What he did want out of the cousins was their unconditional submission to him, and only then will he provide them shelter. Austin wanted to tell Roscoe to go to hell and do a lot more than that, but since he had her in a corner, she took his offer, pleasing him into letting her go. They then forgot that their spat ever happened and devised a way to break Andre, Arlo, and Avery into their arrangement. An hour later, Austin was released from the hospital and Roscoe dropped her off at her home, but not without handing her something for herself and her cousins. That thing was 4 entry cards to a cul-de-sac of cabins looking over a beach on Albalan's east coast. Roscoe owned the properties and charged guests for each month they stayed, making a little extra money on top of the 6 figures he earned as a realtor. Austin led Andre, Arlo, and Avery to believe that her friend wanted them to have a party in the woods with his circle of friends. Her cousins found it odd that a man she's only known for a short time would invite her and them to something so private and far away from the public so soon. But the love Andre, Arlo, and Avery had for Austin manipulated them into looking past that oddity, joining her in making that trip to Roscoe's outdoorsy cul-de-sac. When the cousins arrived a few hours after sunrise, the first thing they noticed was how deep in the shade the court was, making the area much cooler than the space seen by sunlight. Austin yelled to Roscoe that she and her cousins were here, receiving a text from him that instructed her and them to enter the second cabin from the right. Her frown trembled as she led the way to where he wanted her, Andre, Arlo, and Avery, feeling sicker and sicker with each inch closer the 4 of them got. But a few steps shy of touching the front porch, Austin turned back and ran, flinching her cousins into doing the same. A barrage of silenced bullets shattered its windows, blew out its tires, punctured its fuel tank, destroyed its engine, and scared them into falling on each other. After a frantic but brief look around, the cousins saw Roscoe walk out of the middle cabin, smiling with his arms crossed. Austin had nothing to say. Andre gave him a stunned look. Arlo yelled that he effing knew that MF-er was a crook, and Avery wanted to know how could he. Roscoe told the cousins to quit it with the looks and talk, for they now belonged to him as much as his servants have for some time now. He added that, like Austin, Andre, Arlo, Avery, and the people who shot away their car were also under his bondage, serving him knowing that they could be locked up for what they're wanted for if they didn't. Roscoe ordered his servants to emerge so that the cousins could see their partly masked selves, calling them youngsters those 4 could relate to. Arlo yelled that he, Austin, Andre, and Avery will never, ever, ever be anything like his soulless wolves, preferring to die a free man than live as a slave. Roscoe took offense to that and ordered him to take back what he said, getting told to burn in hell and a shaky, scowling middle finger. He had one of his servants fire a non-lethal round across Arlo's nose, crumpling it around his right nostril, then ordered 2 others to whip him bloody with their rifles. save for the rifle whipping, the beating, reminded Austin of the one Janelle inflicted on her, similar in savagery and severity of injury. It left Arlo in a hail of bruises and had him rolling around for any small region of his body that was unharmed but found no spot, pleasing Roscoe into having his servants hold him up for his cousins to look at like a painting to behold. Avery couldn't bear seeing such a face as it contained the horror and betrayal that wrote all over Swindon as she was being smothered. Andre refused to let himself be consumed by his attempt on Jilson's life, calling it all in the past, but Arlo was being eaten by his urge to apologize to Ray for trying to kill her. Reduced to a girl with a fear of the dark, Austin screamed to her cousins how sorry she was for letting Roscoe into their lives. Arlo broke out of the pain, holding him like a wait-a-bit shrub to tell her that she didn't need to apologize for anything. He forgave Austin nevertheless and was sure Andre and Avery would do the same if they had the strength to, explaining how fate wanted the four of them to be together and designated that as being why they're still free. Roscoe would have found that touching had its foundation been set substantively, but chose to delve into that more a little later, for he had revelations to make. He instructed Isidro and Janelle to come out and be a part of his resplendent get-together, jolting the cousins the way a bomb going off would. Austin swore she wasn't seeing Roscoe hug and kiss her attacker and embrace someone whom she thought was his mortal enemy. Isidro said it was nice seeing Roscoe's friend again, and Janelle was equally happy to finally meet Andre, Arlo, and Avery in person. Roscoe told Austin that everything from the trip to the beach to their time in the hospital was part of a plan to add four more if she knew what he meant. Isidro yelled about how disinterested he, his brother, or Janelle were in befriending the cousins, designating friendship as being for the weak and fickle. What he and Roscoe wanted was what pigs like Upton and Dean Jr. aspired to be rulers of, in order no part of the world would be exempt from. Arlo looked at Isidro like he was a lunatic who ought to be in an insane asylum and be left to decay from his own thoughts. Andre said what his cousin was thinking. Austin called Roscoe and his brother no less evil than Gregorio Jr. or Alexis Jr., and Avery nodded her agreeance. Roscoe was sorry that those three felt that way, angering Arlo into telling them to take their fool's remorse and shove it up their a-holes. Isidro liked how loyal the cousins appeared because it made him more certain that internally their ill will for one another was beyond measure. Roscoe had Loretta T. remember that one time she let him in her house to introduce him to Marone K., Lamar R., and Agnes F. Even now, he held the politeness and respect her cousins showed him as if it were a prized possession, but that wasn't the only thing he took note of from that visit. While Loretta T., Marone K., and Lamar R. went out to get meat and produce, Roscoe was alone with Agnes F., her opportunity to air some dirty laundry. Janelle's grim watch on cracked to a cringing one reminiscent of a soul scarred by what Mia, Sonia, and Nova did to it with unshakable glee. Roscoe asked Agnes F. if she didn't mind him asking her what it was like to share a roof with Loretta T, imploring her to be honest and not tell him what he wanted to hear. That shot Austin's nervousness above the Earth's atmosphere, made Andre shiver out in oh no, had Arlo breathing madly, and told Avery that her bean spill was about to be exposed and she'll be thankful for it. Janelle couldn't think no more of how arrogant she was for challenging Mia, Sonia, and Nova head on that night in 2008. But looking back, she thanked the girls for giving her toughness beyond her wildest dreams, finding it unfortunate that Bliss, Andrina, Marti, and Rocio got them instead of her. Janelle gave Isidro glances indicative of a soul made whole by their union coming to be and darkened by the sizable price she paid for it. Avery confided in Roscoe that Austin used to beat her up for fun and have Andre and Arlo join in when they were growing up. She showed him the scars she sustained as well as the makeup she used to conceal them so that no one would ever know. Avery was as scared of what Austin would do if she told anyone about the abuse, begging Roscoe not to tell and having him promise her that with locking pinky fingers. Andre kept calm, but his eyes made his disbelief obvious, whereas Arlo felt like his sweat was making his skin run down and drip off like melting ice cream. The glower Austin gave Avery rewound their minds to the night she beat her for saying she liked what her exploiters did to her. Roscoe congratulated the cousins for being so violent in front of their recently deceased grandmother, adding that it said a lot about who they really were. That wasn't to say he blamed Avery for getting horribly beaten, assuring her that he'll respect her how Austin, Andre, and Arlo should have. Roscoe wasn't the biggest believer of taking an eye for an eye, but said there were times where that reciprocation should apply. He designated Austin's habitual abuse of Avery as being one such instance, ordering that Dan Andre stand and for Arlo to be let go to dwell in his pain. Roscoe took out his cell phone and called the Albaland Police Service, telling them that he'd like to report the whereabouts of four fugitives wanted for separate attempted murders in Bromelia. He said those would-be murderers were Austin, Andre, Arlo, and Avery, adding that they were staying at the address of 615 Newark Avenue in Somalba, Albaland. When asked to identify himself, Roscoe said he preferred to remain anonymous, then hung up without giving the operator a chance to respond. Avery asked him if he knew that the cops could trace the call he just made and realized that the authorities now had his voice on file. Roscoe assured her that there was no chance of him being tracked down, explaining that his vocal cords weren't what the operator heard. He described his cell phone as a tool that could do so much more than hide where he was and what he sounded like, cradling it in his hands like a jewel that mustn't leave his person. Roscoe yelled that he and Isidro were indestructible and that their alliance was strengthening and sharpening by the day. He made it clear to the cousins that their only path to survival was joining him in seizing control of Albaland beyond and ultimately the whole world. Roscoe said that what they were wanted for was all he needed to know that their hearts were nastier than black mold. He added that like himself, Austin, Andre, Arlo, and Avery were hungry and desired to be the ones standing on the Earth's pedestals. Roscoe requested that they reflect on all that they've done or endured throughout their lives and let it awake their most honest selves. Austin fought back to the afternoon she was taken by the people who'd subsequently exploit her, trembling her tears onto her fists. Andre recalled the morning he was beaten by 6 teenage yuppies who wanted to know what it felt like to batter a homeless child. Arlo remembered the dusk that saw him be robbed of the money he earned from the cans he recycled as well as all the clothes he had on. Avery looked back on the evening that 10 of her peers from school turned her into a thing for them to play with and mess up. The cousins then recalled the night they stole from Robbie the Fourth the moment Austin beat him to death and their embrace shortly after. In their minds, it didn't matter what side they were on or whether their loyalty was to anyone outside their circle. Their foremost priority was them surviving as 4. That took the cousins to the decision of declaring themselves as part of an entity that'll hand them the pedestals they so desired. With Isidro being ecstatic and Janelle unable to be any happier, Roscoe smiled and had his servants give Austin, Arlo, Andre, and Avery a round of applause. The cousins then realized that they'll have to answer for their betrayal of Upton sooner or later, but weren't too worried about what he'd do, believing that they were in excellent hands. Roscoe and Isidro weren't aware of this former affiliation and didn't know that the home at 615 Newark Avenue had been broken into. This was because neither brother had anything to do with that specific crime, and as fate would have it, the parties involved would reveal themselves, but they'd be far from alone in their walks out of the shadows. And that was the new Hoods Warn. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the story I just gave. Share this show with everyone you know. Make sure they share it with everyone they know. Check out my website at www.rss.com/podcasts/The Dystopian Republic. Send me your respectful questions and constructive feedback at RaulGuerreroJr95@gmail.com. On that note, I'm Raul Guerrero, and come again for another gripping, thoughtful, and sinister episode of The Dystopian Republic.